Commissioner Crispin wants a good gavel rap. Ready, Randy?
Always.
How's that?
When that thing raps, all right, I'm ready.
All right, good morning, everyone. This is Commissioner Brian Colquhoun meeting for our regularly scheduled commission meeting. It is Wednesday, September 17th, approximately 10 a.m. Like I said, we're meeting for our regularly scheduled commission meeting. Just have a couple opening comments. Last week, we had the Reliability Symposium in Fargo. I thought that went really, really well and picked up a lot of information there. So we'll probably talk about that some more later on at the end here. But I thought that was very good. But then it was just yesterday we saw the EPA now has extended the deadline period for comment to 45 days. And I have mixed emotions on that. One is, okay, fine, it's good to have another 45 days so we can continue to discuss with other states what we would like to do and continue to make sure our filing is as accurate as can be. But the other side of the coin is I think this is still a continued delaying effort by the administration to kick the can down the road. The 45 days, while it does give us some more time to make sure that the comments are filed correctly and accurately, we would have been able to do that anyway with October 16th. So I see this as a double-edged sword. So, but that being said, we'll still make sure the comments are there, and we'll, I'm sure, use all the time we can. We just received a contact today from the Arizona Commission. Different states now are really reaching out to each other to see what the other states are going to do, and I really think this whole states' rights versus federal rights is really going to solidify in the next few days on this. So other than that, I won't talk any more about the Bison until the January 2015 game. So other than that, I'll turn it over to
really?
Commissioner Crispin.
Are you going to put that in writing?
Just did.
Well, I'm going to take one opportunity to talk about the undefeated Bison, since there are two of us Hayes and Bison here today in the room. to enjoy our undefeated season that we have going. But, you know, to add to your point, I agree with the things that you said regarding our reliability conference in Fargo. I thought also it was very useful, and we had, I think, the right people in the room and got a lot of good information on it regarding the extension. I know there – I agree that I felt we could have gotten our comments in, you know, in a timely manner. Without the extension, I know there were some people who were clamoring for more time, but the fact of the matter is, as long as the extension time is being drug out, the EPA is winning. Nothing is being built with this hanging over our heads, and so that's what I find to really be the sad part of the whole thing, that without doing anything, they win as well. So that's really hamstringing our state and our nation. We also, the week before that, had the meeting in Fargo with the STB, and I believe that was the first field hearing they have held in a number of years, and felt that we had good dialogue, and it's going to be very interesting. I think that the STB is realizing the enormity of the problem that we have with our rail system and around the country, but especially here in the Midwest. And I think they're taking it seriously, and it'll be real interesting in what kind of changes they come down with here in the coming days. I think Julie will be talking probably a little bit about that, our comments there. But I thought that we got a good opportunity to talk and were listened to, and they engaged us in some dialogue back and forth, and I just thought it was real useful.
Thank you, Commissioner. Commissioner
Brochek? Sure. Just a couple of thoughts on the reliability hearing or discussion in Fargo. I thought, too, it was a great discussion. We had two of the top energy regulators in the country with us there, with Tony Clark from FERC and Jerry Colley from the NERC organization, which is responsible for reliability and holding companies responsible for reliability nationwide. And he had some very chilling comments, I thought, about the EPA rules and what kind of research has been done on those rules to prove that they will not affect reliability. He basically said there has been no research on these rules to determine their impact on reliability, and cautioned that needs to be completed before these rules are finalized and implemented and enforced. So I thought that it was great to have him here. I've heard him talk at NARUC before. That's why I was intent on getting him here, because I've heard him make these comments. It's just you don't see them reported or discussed or getting much traction publicly. But I think that he makes a very good warning. And it was particularly disturbing because when Gina McCarthy was here in North Dakota last fall or last spring, I can't remember, last spring, I believe, she started her comments by pledging that the EPA will not affect reliability with these decisions, with their carbon rules. And here's the chief regulator on reliability in the country saying that they haven't done any homework and any analysis of the reliability impact of these rules. So that was really discouraging to me. I think the public expects that that's happening and that the powers that be in this country who are overseeing this industry are doing that kind of homework to ensure that we can implement these new standards and new guidelines and make these kind of requirements without jeopardizing the reliability that's central to everyday life and our economy as a whole and the health of our economy. So I thought that was pretty disturbing. She also talked about not being willing to impact costs as well, which is a whole separate issue that we know that these are going to impact cost. But that aside, reliability is a great concern, and that was one of the focuses of that discussion. So in terms of the delay or the extension of time, EPA has been unreasonable with what they're the time frame that they are expecting these rules to be implemented. I'm more concerned about the time frame from the final passage of the rule to when the state has to have its plan developed. That's really unreasonable, especially when you extend these kind of deadlines. You're just making it more and more difficult. I personally think what people need is not more time, but more clarity. Nobody can determine what these rules are, what they're expecting. They contradict each other in that 640 pages. And so what companies and health departments and public service commissions nationwide need is clarity on what the rules actually do and what their parameters are going to be. So I wish that the EPA would take a step back, further define the rules, and then create another public comment period. And maybe that's what they'll end up doing. But so that's all the comments I have, I guess, about the reliability issue and EPA carbon dioxide rules. We can talk about STB maybe at the end if you're interested, Dave, to talk about what we discussed with the EPA or STB and what we have asked for. And we'll be following back up here in the next couple of weeks to see if they intend to implement any of the four things that we requested. Let's see. Was I going to say anything else? I think that's enough. We'll just move on. Move on to the agenda.
Thank you, Commissioner. We have several items on consent today. I'd move passage of the items on consent.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any discussion? Since none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Motion is approved.
Okay, thank you, Darrell. We'll go right to the regular agenda, item BK1. I move the commission adopt the supplemental order issuing first amended corridor certificate number 152 and first amended route permit number 164 and Basin Electric Power Cooperative 345 kV transmission line Mercer Dunn McKenzie Williams siting application case number PU11-696.
Second.
In April of this year, the Commission issued a corridor certificate number 152 and route permit number 164 for Basin Electric to authorize approximately 197 miles of 345 kV and 230 kV associated with its facilities extending from the AVS near Beulah to the Nested substation near Tioga. A lot of process there took place, a lot of hearings, and we got to the order. And then once the company, there was a lot of contingencies in our initial order, make sure they had final Forest Service approval, make sure they had the final SHPO approval, make sure they had all these other things. So we anticipated there would be some modifications that came through. And so basically what ended up happening in August of this year, in July of this year, Basin Electric filed an amended application for corridor and route modifying at least four locations along the approved corridor and route. In August of this year, the commission deemed the amended application complete and issued notice of filing and notice of opportunity. What it really came down to is the four modifications that one is based on requested a corridor and route modification to shift 2 mile segment of the new AVS line by the NESA 345 KV corridor and route south to the existing AVS broadband right of way, and then to give the actual definition. So a slight modification to the south in one area. The second was in McKenzie County, realignment of approximately 2,000 feet of the approved corridor and route, shifting further east of Highway 85 a maximum of 300 feet to accommodate U.S. Forest Service requests. So the basically, as the process laid out with the Forest Service, they received a request to move a little bit, and it certainly made sense as we went through it. The next alignment, also in McKenzie County, shifting approximately a half mile west in the previous alignment to accommodate a future substation. And finally, also in McKenzie County, a slight westward adjustment of approximately three-quarters of a mile on the approved corridor and route on the south side of the Missouri River crossing to accommodate a North Dakota game and fish request. I should note that none of these modifications were in the what I would call the more controversial area south of the battlefield. They're all areas that, like you said, I noticed, you know, the game and fish request, the Forest Service request. So it's really part of the refinement of the process. We did put this out if anyone requested an official hearing. They did not. No new exclusion and avoidance areas were identified. The reroute would result in 0.2 fewer acres of Little Missouri National grasslands being crossed. The cultural survey was completed, and everything certainly appears to be in order. And I've also seen the reporting that the basin got their final approval from the Forest Service in some other areas. So this project is moving along very nicely. And I'll go back to just commend my colleagues and our staff on this one, that when we made the decision to approve our route with some contingencies, there's a lot of folks that said, well, you shouldn't be doing this now. You should study. And we said, no, the facts that we look at are good. So we approved it. And then it really, I think, drove the Forest Service and others to get to the point where they would make their decision. So here we are now in, not quite late 2014 yet, but Basin needs to build this power line to meet energy demand. So I really think it was our move first to get this taken care of that really prompted the rest of this to come together, because if we would still be waiting for the NEPA to make our decision, well, so now we'd have part of the NEPA back now, and now we'd be starting to deliberate our decision. So I think we really handled this one correct. It's the way to do things, and just thank staff and the company for giving us the information that we could to make these decisions.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion?
Yeah, this particular power line might be the most important single step that there is in making sure that we figure out a way to meet power needs up in northwest North Dakota in the coming years. And, I think the fact that there are only four relatively small adjustments in their schedule is kind of a credit to Basin Electric and their planning people. The fact that they had this thing planned out pretty well from the beginning, but then were reasonable. They made accommodations to the Forest Service, made accommodations to the Game and Fish, made accommodations, or adjustments, I guess, rather, for just making it a better system. But they're relatively small, shows it was well thought out from the beginning, but they still approached the final detailing of the plan with an open mind. And so I think you're right that this commission played a big role in getting this thing moving forward. And I think that all players involved then took responsible actions and brought this together well. So I'm really pleased about the direction that this plan has come.
Just to chime in as well on this, and it was great to see that they received approval yesterday, and now they can begin construction. I've been fond of a little model that one of the co-op heads out west carries around that describes the growth that his area is experiencing, the upper Missouri GNT up south or west of Williston. And he has a model of Legos that shows that in 2004 they had under 200 megawatts of demand. In 2014, it had grown to 800 megawatts of demand, and in 2024, it's going to be over 2,000 megawatts of demand just in that area. In order to meet that demand, you have got to have strong transmission infrastructure to bring the power in, and this project is key to doing that. So I'm excited that it's moving forward, and I hope that we have an easy construction season and there aren't any delays moving ahead on this project.
Is there any further discussion? Sensing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, motion is approved.
Thank you, Daryl. Item BK2. I move the commission deem the application complete, conditioned upon filing a final transmission line structure locations at least 10 days prior to hearing, initiate a notice of filing, a notice of hearing, in Antelope Hills Wind Project, LLC, 345 kV transmission line, Mercer County, citing application case number PU14678, and Antelope Hills Wind Project, LLC, wind energy conversion facility, Mercer County, citing application case number PU14-679.
Second.
Hey, Jerry, could we talk to Alana, too, about adding some more legal terms in our motions? All right. Anyway.
They're in danger of actually being understandable.
Absolutely. All right, I digress. In March of this year, AVS filed a consolidated application for a corridor certificate, route permit, and a waiver of procedure and time schedules to construct approximately 9.5 miles of 345 kV electric transmission line and associated facilities in Mercer County, North Dakota, with the appropriate case number. They also filed an application for a certificate of site compatibility to construct 172 megawatts of a wind energy project consisting of up to 85 wind turbine generators and associated facilities. The proposed wind project project area, along with the proposed map, are shown in the attached map, and so we should have those out there for anyone looking. But basically, if you go north and west of Beulah, straight north of Zap, north and east of Golden Valley, south, of course, of the lake, that would be the project area. Is that District 33, Commissioner Christman?
That is District 33.
Just checking on that. The energy capital of the country and the world, right? Public hearings are scheduled to begin October 23rd, 2014, at 9 a.m. for the wind project and at 1 p.m. Central Daylight Time for the transmission line. Well, of course, we'll go through our hearing process. This is just to show that we continue to see wind projects in the state, and so we continue to have more energy generation. And, Jerry, did we get a cost back yet from the company cost estimate?
I wasn't able to get exact numbers, but I can give a ballpark staff estimate. I put it in the neighborhood of $250 million for the wind project and probably $9 million for the transmission line.
So just for staff estimate is $250 million for the wind project, $9 million for the transmission line, using the ever-faithful about $1 million a mile for transmission and the wind projects as well. So this is not a well, I guess we don't know if it's built, who the power would go to. So, but in the case of this, the application is complete. We've scheduled the hearings. We tried to be efficient with our time to schedule them both the same day with the splitting of the one to start at 9, the other to start at 1 o'clock. If we are still going at 1 o'clock with the first hearing, then, of course, we'll make adjustments. But it seems to be a reasonable time frame given the time we've spent on hearings in these areas on the wind farm. So everything appears to be in order.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion? Sensing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, motion is approved.
All right, thank you, Daryl. And finally, for me, item BK3. I move the commission adopt the order certifying use of Federal Universal Service Support in Public Service Commission USF Use Certification 47 CFR 53.314, compliance case number PU14-622.
Second.
Just a little background in this case. The Section 254 of the Telecom Act requires that telecommunication carriers that use Universal Service Support that they use it only for the provisions of maintenance and upgrading of facilities of which the support is intended. And basically every year, September 14th of each year, each of the companies that receives UFSF must certify to the Public Service Commission that they are using these funds in the manner that they must. And so this order today really lays out, I'm not going to go through all the companies, but we really have the order breaks them out into several different blocks. And the only reason there's different blocks is that depending upon the certification format that the companies use, some certify the terminology preceding calendar year. Some use the term 2013 and 2015. So we broke them out just to make sure we're exactly legally correct for every one of the terminologies on the letter. But really this is just our oversight of Section 254 of the Telecom Act. And I would just say that this order today is, of course, I think in good order. But the discussion on USF, we get so much focus on energy development and what's going on in the state, and these are all good things about transmission build-out, but there's still a backdrop of a huge telecom build-out going on in the state. I just saw where Midcontinent was named the number one quick broadband provider, and they're a new company in North Dakota. I know that our telcos have almost completed their broadband deployment throughout the state of North Dakota. Most of them have. And so just in my time here in the last 6 years, we've seen the broadband growth just unbelievable. The better access to rural areas, the growth of the energy boom, I think, has led to a telecom boom. We've got more companies coming to operate in the state. So it's all good. But one thing to talk about uncertainty is the USF debate continues about what type of funding will go to the Universal Service Fund to help some of these areas offset some of their costs. And the challenge is a lot of these companies made these big broadband investments based on what they thought the continued USF support would be, and that is in flux. So there's one more thing that we need to keep an eye on. And one thing that about USF, it's not a tax. It's not something that Congress appropriates. It's a fee that people pay in. So it's one of those things when people talk about you have to cut the federal debt, I agree with that. But the USF is not tied to that. It's a whole separate discussion. So we're, of course, waiting to see how that all plays out in the whole cycle of different what the FCC does. And there's also several cases that are pending they're ongoing in different jurisdictions around the country about the regulation of Internet. You know, if you're using your broadband as a telephone, there's regulation on it. If you're using it as an Internet, there's no regulation, which I agree with that. But we've seen bills in the state of North Dakota, and I'm sure we'll see them again this next session, trying to further deregulate or regulate broadband deployment. So we are certainly focused on all the energy development, but we haven't lost focus of what's going on in the state for telecom. So use my chance to grandstand about that a little bit. But the order is everything in the order is in order.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion?
I will just add that, I think our telecommunications in North Dakota has been one of the keys in early planning and good business development that, you know, started back in the 80s and 90s when things weren't going well, that has helped pave the way for the prosperity that we're seeing today. In my legislative races and talking about telecommunications, they used to say that for a lot of marketing things, it doesn't matter whether you live in New Salem or New York. The world is at your doorstep with the Internet, and telecommunications companies in North Dakota have really been leaders in making that work. So just wanted to point that out.
Is there any other further discussion? Sensing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion is approved.
Thank you, Darrell. That concludes my portfolio. Commissioner Crispin.
Mr. Chairman, if there's no objection, I'd like to take RC2 before RC1.
Fine by me.
Okay.
Sure.
I move the commission present the 2014 North Dakota Award for Excellence in Surface Coal Mining and Reclamation to the Falkirk Mining Company.
Second.
PSC adopted the North Dakota Award for Excellence in Surface Coal Mining and Reclamation many years ago. The award program sets out criteria for the commission to present a coal mining and reclamation award during the Lignite Energy Council's annual meeting. We're recommending one of this year's awards be presented to the Falkirk Mining Company for remining an abandoned underground mine east of Underwood. The former Figginskow mine, and we don't get to say Figginskow often here, but we do today, is located about 3 miles east of Underwood, just north of State Highway 200, and the mine covers about 55 acres. Mining was conducted at the Figginskow mine from 1933 until 1948, and I like to just imagine that, you know, the toughest years, the Depression and World War II. And approximately 300,000 tons of coal was mined. About a third of the coal was mined by underground mining there, and the overburden thickness above the coal ranged from 30 to 90 feet, and roofs on many of the underground mine rooms have collapsed, resulting in hazardous sinkholes on the surface. A few years ago, Falkirk developed plans to re-mine the Figginskow mine using surface mining methods to recover most of the coal that remained in the area. These plans were approved by this commission in July of 2013, Falkirk is currently removing as much topsoil as can be safely pushed off between the sinkholes that are present. No subsoil is being salvaged for safety reasons. Falkirk started remining the area in the fall of 2013. Completion is expected in 2017. The approved post-mining land use for these remined lands is hayland. And another benefit of Falkirk's remining of the Figgenskow mine is that it eliminates this area for a possible reclamation under the PSC's AML program. So any funds that would have been used for filling sinkholes in the area will now be available for other AML projects.
We have a motion and a second. Is there further discussion?
Well, I'd just like to chime in here a bit. I love this project. I was out there this summer and on a tour of this part of the mine and saw some of those old abandoned mine shafts. You could see it in the strip mining operations. You could see it on the cut, and it really was interesting to think about the folks down in those mines doing the mining back in the 30s and how hard that work was and just how brave those people were. And this project is great because it makes this area safer, and it also extracts the resources that are there for good use. And so I think it's just a win-win. It's a really solid project, and I commend Falkirk for their pursuit of it, and I'm happy to sign on to them receiving this award.
Lastly, I just want to point on a lighter note. I used to talk to a lot of the older people who worked in the underground coal mines at Beulah, and there was one old guy that came by where I worked at the time, and when he'd see us visiting around, he'd always say, "Too many lights?" And I didn't get what that meant, and one time I just confronted him and asked him, and he said down in the mines, they'd be down there all day long. In fact, supposedly there were mules down there that were born in the mines, lived their lives, and never seen the light of day. But these men would go in and work their shifts in total darkness, except for the lights from their hats. And so when they'd be loafing around a little bit and visiting, the supervisors would see the lights in a group and get them back to work by saying, "Too many lights." So when you see those old underground mines in the side of the walls now, imagine those guys just trying to get a breather and getting hollered at.
Yeah. And just because I've never said Figgenskow, now I have to say it once, and now I have. I didn't know that was the name of that mine.
Is there any further discussion? Since none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion is approved.
Okay, now my second motion, which is actually RC1. I move the commission present the 2014 North Dakota Award for Excellence in Surface Coal Mining and Reclamation to Mr. Jim Deutsch.
Second.
In addition to the recommendation that the Falkirk Mining Company receive an award, several staff members suggested that our own Jim Deutsch would also be a good candidate. Jim has been a part of the North Dakota Coal Regulatory Program for the past 40 years, having begun his employment with the PSC in 1974. With the passage of the Federal Surface Mining Control and Reclamation Act in 1977, he was a key staff member in securing state primacy in 1980. Jim served as the assistant director of the Reclamation Division for a number of years and became the director in 1997. He has also served as the director of the Abandoned Mine Lands Division with the PSC since 2006. Jim maintains good working relationships with all stakeholders. He's responsive to the needs of landowners, citizen groups, mining companies, and other units of government. He works to ensure that landowners' rights are protected while providing the required environmental protection and ensures that the reclamation laws and rules are enforced uniformly and fairly. Under Jim's leadership, all North Dakota coal mines have been held to high standards, as evidenced by the many national reclamation awards that have been won by North Dakota mining companies. And although North Dakota is a major coal producer, our coal regulatory program has one of the smallest staffs in the country. This is primarily due to the efficiency of the programs administered by Jim. North Dakota's reclamation program is routinely cited by the Federal Office of Surface Mining as a model for efficiency and effectiveness. This is primarily due to the excellent leadership and direction that Jim has provided and the excellent team he has assembled.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion?
You go ahead.
Jim, did we keep it a surprise till now?
I found out last week and I couldn't put a stop to it.
Well, I just, we've got some great staff in the Public Service Commission, but Jim is, literally, he wrote the book on coal reclamation and what's going on. I mean, when I started back in 2009, you get around and you meet the staff, and they're all very good, but it didn't take long just to realize how much knowledge that Jim Deutsch has, not only about the North Dakota programs, about the national programs, how well-respected he is throughout the country. Every Public Service Commission forum I go to, when they talk about our mining program, is Jim Deutsch still there? And he is, and we need him to stay a few more years, Jim. But really, Jim, you've done a superb job up there, and I just want to personally thank you for your knowledge that you've brought to the table for many, many years, but particularly the last 2-3 years. There's been a lot going on up in the commission that has really set the tone for, I think, the next few years. But it's amazing to have someone that's that dedication to something for that long. When I think about it, Jim, I mean, you do a superb job with your staff. You train them as a team. You are technically proficient. And I could go on and on and on. But I really want to thank you, Jim. And the last thing, which we cannot forget, is Jim is a graduate of North Dakota State University. Thank you, Jim.
Well, I have to say a couple words about Jim as well. Jim is a model public servant. I think that's sums him up. His work on behalf of the people of the state has just been phenomenal. People may not know you exist, Jim, but they can drive by the land in coal country and see the fingerprints of your work. And that's really a testament to your hard work and dedication, your leadership here at the commission, of the other staff, your high standards. Not only do you expect great work, but you get great work, and people love working for you. So you can't ask for anything more than that out of a leader. And it's been my honor the last couple years to work with you and learn from you. And I have some projects in mind for the next near future, and hoping to tap your experience and wisdom and expertise in reclamation on the coal side and apply that in some areas where we're struggling with reclamation, especially in terms of pipelines. And so I will be talking to you about that here shortly. But I really think we can learn a lot on reclamation in pipelines from what we're doing with the have done in the coal side of things, and can come a long way to solving some of the issues that we have with landowners and healing some of those wounds and moving forward in a productive way with industry and landowner relations. So looking forward to talking to you about that and working with you on that. And thank you for all your great service.
Is there any further discussion?
Well, my final thought on this is that the only way I even agreed to sign off on this award was making it clear that this is not a retirement situation. This is just marking the first 40 years.
Yeah. And,
there is so much good that comes out of our coal industry in our state. And that's why I was so proud to represent that area in the Senate for those years. And a lot of it's attributable to what we do here and what Jim has led. And we really need to keep this going. And there are just a whole lot of people, if they really understood and knew what goes on behind the scenes, would just have nothing but admiration and respect and appreciation for all you've done here, Jim.
Is there any further discussion?
I'll pile on one more time. Actually, Julie reminded me of this commission for the first time ever just went through some wind reclamation projects. Mm-hmm. And Jim and his folks were instrumental in helping us shape those initial steps in wind reclamation. So it's pipelines, it's coal, it's wind. His expertise has helped out a lot of different areas. And as we continue to figure out exactly what it's going to be for final bond release for the financial assurances for wind farm, where I'm sure we're going to lean heavily on Jim and his crowd. So it's not only coal, it's all types of energy in the state. So thanks.
Is there further discussion? Sensing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion is approved.
RC3, I move the commission adopt an order in case number GE-14-615 granting the request of Trinidad Benham Corporation of Denver, Colorado to operate as a facility-based grain buyer at Cummins, North Dakota, effective immediately.
Second.
Trinidad Benham is establishing a license at this facility as a convenience to farmers for receiving dry edible beans. And they have not received any beans at Cummings. However, dry edible bean harvest is getting started, and they anticipate farmers will be ready to deliver soon. Trinidad Benham licensed its first North Dakota grain warehouse in 2002. In 2011, they began operating their North Dakota facilities under facility-based grain buyer licenses. And they have facilities licensed at Colgate, Courtney, Finley, Pillsbury, and now with this Cummings facility, we'll have a combined capacity of just under 212,000 bushels in the state. Statutory compliance has been met, and staff recommends that the license be issued.
We have a motion and a second. Is there further discussion? Sensing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Motion is approved.
RC4, I move the commission adopt an order in case number GE-14-708, granting the request of Dakota Spirit Ag Energy, LLC, to operate a 530,000 bushel grain warehouse at Wimbledon, North Dakota, effective October 1st, 2014.
Second.
In June of this year, the commission issued a roving grain buyer license to Dakota Spirit for the purpose of soliciting corn for delivery to its ethanol facility that is currently under construction near Spiritwood. Dakota Spirit is applying for a grain warehouse license now at Wimbledon to secure additional corn inventories for that Spiritwood facility when it's done. They informed the commission they have not begun any grain warehouse activities at Wimbledon and ask that their license be effective October 1st. They expect the Spiritwood facility to be completed in April of next year and will obtain a grain warehouse license for Spiritwood once construction is completed. Statutory compliance has been met, and staff recommends a grain warehouse license at Wimbledon be approved.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion? Sensing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion is approved.
Okay, and finally, RC5, I move the commission adopt an order in case number GE-14-710, canceling warehouse license number 863, issued to Mayport Farmers Co-op at rural Portland, North Dakota, and ordering that business at Portland Rural be under license number 863 is discontinued effective immediately.
Second.
Just so you know, there's three Portland facilities at play here. There's Portland Rural that we're dealing with. I'll also, as I lay this out, there's also a regular Portland facility and then a Portland Bean facility. So it's a little bit confusing.
Thank you for explaining that. I wanted to know what the different... Portland's pretty rural no matter where you're at.
Yeah, yeah. On October 26th, Mayport Farmers Co-op filed a request to discontinue business for its licensed grain warehouse at Portland Rural. It's also known as Portland Junction. This facility is in the process of being sold to SRS Commodities, and SRS anticipates obtaining a license once the purchase has been completed. The facility is empty. There are no outstanding storage obligations at this location. Mayport Farmers Co-op continues to operate licensed grain warehouses at Portland, and that's the regular one in Portland Bean, and also at Mayville.
We have a motion and a second. Is there further discussion?
Well, I'd just add that 2 years ago there was a fire up in that area that one of the elevators got destroyed, so it's really nice to see the communities getting all the elevators back up and running, and that area is really... If you haven't been through Mayville, Portland lately, that area of all the areas in the state, that's booming almost as much as the West. There's just a lot going on up there. They're in a nice little sweet spot between transportation and a bunch of other things.
Yep, and as more farmers switch to crops that produce more bushels, as well as the dramatic increase in productivity by individual farmers per acre, this kind of storage is very valuable and needed.
Is there further discussion? Sensing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Motion is approved.
Anything else, Commissioner?
That's it.
All right, Commissioner Fedorchak.
All right. I move the Commission adopt the findings of fact, conclusions of law, and order issuing Certificate of Public Convenience and Necessity number 5845 in Montana Dakota Utility Companies, a division of MD Resources Group, Inc., Menard, Inc., Burley County, North Dakota Public Convenience and Necessity, case number PU-13-871.
Second.
On November 25th of 2013, MDU, a division of MD Resources Group, submitted an application to extend electric service to Menards, Inc., at a location adjacent to the unincorporated community of McKenzie. On January 16th of 2014, a Capital Electric Cooperative Incorporated filed a protest and a request for hearing on this application. On February 26th, the Commission issued a notice of hearing and scheduled a public hearing to be held on Friday, May 2nd. This is a tough decision. The fact that it's here is the first indication that there's not a lot of clarity in terms of who should automatically be allowed to serve this load. And it's really an important matter to both parties. So I felt like we were picking between two winners in this case, folks that I had great respect, appreciation for, and good relationships with on all sides. That said, it's our task to decide who serves this load. And the law provides 10 key issues to guide that decision. And so we really focus methodically on those issues. And I'll go through those in a minute after I establish more of the time frame for our action. On May 2nd, a public hearing on the application was held as scheduled. On June 13th, Montana Dakota filed a request for oral argument before the commission. June 19th, Capital Electric filed an objection to this request. And on June 25th, the commission granted Montana Dakota's request for oral argument. On July 14th, we scheduled the argument to be held on July 28th and set the parameters for the briefing and the argument. They filed their briefs, and on July 28th, the oral argument was held as scheduled. So having completed all that work and held the hearings and received the filings, here are the 10 issues that we worked through and our findings of fact on them. First, for issue number one, from whom does the customer prefer electric service? Montana Dakota's application included an appearance form signed by Menard, Inc., indicating it desires electric service at the Menard site from Montana, Dakota. The center requires three-phase electric service at each of several locations on the site, and the anticipated total electric load of the site will be approximately 1.2 megawatts. At the hearing, Mr. Steve Manner testified on behalf of Menards that they desire to receive electric service at the site from Montana, Dakota for four reasons. First, Menard expects to realize an annual savings of approximately $62,000 by receiving electric service from Montana, Dakota. Montana, Dakota also offers rate schedules for interruptible service and demand response programs that provide further opportunities for cost savings as Menard plans to install customer-owned generation on the site. Third, the quality and reliability of service are important considerations to Menard, and Montana Dakota's ability to provide service with less voltage drop was an important to their operation of equipment at that site. And fourth, Menard prefers to receive its electric. They testified at the hearing they prefer to receive their electric service from a provider whose rates and services are subject to regulatory oversight. So on the customer preference side, Menard was clear in stating they wanted Montana, Dakota. The second issue was what electric suppliers are operating in the general area. Both Montana, Dakota, and Capital Electric are the only electric suppliers operating in the general area of the site. Montana, Dakota has held a franchise since 1928 to serve the community of McKenzie, which is immediately adjacent to the site, the Menard site. Capital Electric provides single-phase service to rural customers adjacent to the site. The third issue, what electric supply lines exist in at least a two-mile radius of the location to be served, and when were they constructed? Both companies have infrastructure in this area. Montana Dakota owns and operates a transmission line originating in Bismarck, extending in an easterly direction along I-94. The transmission line is two-way or looped supply for Montana Dakota's substation located north of McKinsey, which in turn supplies Montana Dakota's distribution system serving those customers in McKinsey and the surrounding areas. Capital Electric proposes to serve the Menard site from the Minocan substation, located approximately 8 miles west of McKinsey. Capital Electric has an underground three-phase distribution line which runs from the Minocan substation along the south side of I-94, an underground single-phase distribution line which runs south from the I-94 for approximately 1 mile to the area of the Menard site. So both electric suppliers will need to construct extensions to existing three-phase electric supply lines to serve the Menard site. MDU would convert 3,000-foot to three-phase, and Capital Electric would have to convert 1 mile to three-phase. Fourth issue, what customers are served by electric suppliers within at least a two-mile radius of location? Montana Dakota has 29 customers within the two-mile radius. 28 of those are located within a one-mile radius. Capital Electric serves 11 customers within a two-mile radius, and four of those are located within a one-mile radius. So Montana Dakota had more customers within a one-mile and two-mile radius. Number five, what are the differences, if any, between the electric suppliers available to serve the area with respect to reliability of service? Montana Dakota would serve the site over approximately 8,700 feet of radial distribution line from the McKenzie substation. Capital Electric would serve the Menard site over approximately 9 miles of distribution line from the Minocan substation. Both provided voltage studies to the commission, and the comparison of voltage drops showed a slight improvement with MDU. The commission finds that either supplier would be able to serve the Menard site with sufficient reliability. However, Montana Dakota's substation is located closer to the Menard site, which could provide increased reliability because there would be less voltage drop and less line length upon which a fault could occur. The sixth issue, which of the available electric suppliers will be able to serve the location in question more economically and still earn an adequate return on its investment? Montana Dakota would serve the Menard site by extending its existing three-phase system at McKenzie and converting that system at the McKenzie substation from Delta three-phase to Y three-phase. This conversion will upgrade and increase the capacity of Montana Dakota's existing three-phase system sufficiently to serve the Menard site and any additional load requests likely to result in the community of McKenzie. Montana Dakota's estimated total cost to extend secondary service to the Menard site is just over $190,000. Their annual revenue requirement associated with this investment is $27,872. Capital Electric would extend service to the Menard site by installing 1 mile of new phases on its current single-phase service between its existing three-phase system and the Menard site. This would cost about $110,000. They did not provide an annual revenue requirement for recovering the cost of its proposed extension. But the costs of the project include the cost to extend service as well as the cost of service to the customer. So that's another important consideration. The annual cost to the customer to provide electric service to the Menard site by MDU is $513,669,000, and the annual cost of the customer from Capital Electric would be $575,883,000. The annual cost to the customer for Capital Electric to provide electric service to the Menard site is approximately $62,000 more, 11% more than the annual costs for the customer under MDU. Therefore, the commission finds that Montana Dakota will be able to serve the Menard site location more economically and still earn an adequate return on its investment. Number 7, which supplier's extended electric service would best serve orderly and economic development of electric service in the general area? Montana Dakota's electric provider within the community of McKenzie and has been there since 1928. The northwest corner of the Menard site is immediately adjacent to the southeast corner of the McKenzie. Montana Dakota serves more customers within both the 2-mile and a 1-mile radius of the Menard site than does Capital Electric. Service by Montana Dakota to the Menard site is an extension and continuation of the existing electric services it has provided to the community of McKenzie for 86 years. Upgrades to serve the Menard site will also result in an upgrade of the 3-phase system serving the community of McKenzie and provide additional capacity on that system for new load that can be anticipated as a result of the 240 jobs created at the Menard site. Service by Montana Dakota would benefit not only development of the Menard site, but also orderly and economic development of the community of McKenzie. An additional consideration of which supplier would best serve orderly and economic development in these cases is whether a supplier's cost to provide service to a customer exceeds the cost to provide service to the customer from a second supplier. Montana Dakota's cost of providing service to the Menard site are $62,000 less than Capital Electric's, which improves the financial viability and success of the manufacturing distribution center. For these reasons, the Commission finds that service by Montana Dakota to the Menard site best serves the community of McKenzie and realizes a significant cost savings to Menard, Inc. Therefore, extension of service by Montana Dakota best serves orderly and economic development of electric service in the general area. Number 8, would approval of the application result in wasteful duplication of investment or services? The Commission finds that approval of the application would not result in wasteful duplication of investment or services, again, because the Montana Dakota's proposed addition of a larger transformer and conversion to the Y system will improve Montana Dakota's electric service within the community of McKenzie and help meet potential growth resulting from approximately 240 new jobs in that area. Is it probable that the location in question will be included within the corporate limits of municipality within the foreseeable future? That's issue number 9. There's no evidence of that. Issue number 10 also was neutral. Will service by either electrical suppliers in the area unreasonably interfere with the service or system of the other? We found that they would not. Montana Dakota and its predecessors have been serving the community of McKenzie directly adjacent to the Menard site since 1928, in close proximity to Capital Electric system, which was built to serve rural areas for which central power was not otherwise available. The Territorial Integrity Act does not provide that rural electric cooperatives are the preferred supplier of electric service in all rural areas of the state, but rather requires a public utility to obtain a certificate of public convenience and necessity before it extends facilities in a rural area. The public utility must show that public convenience and necessity reasonably requires such an extension. The Commission finds that public convenience and necessity reasonably require the approval of Montana Dakota's application because the customer prefers electric service from Montana Dakota as it results in more than $60,000 in annual cost savings and better meets the customer's needs. Because Montana Dakota has served customers in the area since 1928 and has more customers within a 1-mile and 2-mile radius of the location. Because Montana Dakota substation is located closer to the Menard site, providing less voltage drop and less line length on which a fault could occur. Because the proposed extension of Montana Dakota's 3-phase system to serve the site is shorter than the proposed extension of Capital Electric's 3-phase system. Because Montana Dakota will serve the Menard site more economically when considering both the cost to extend service and the annual cost to the customers reflected in rates for service. And because Montana Dakota's extension of service would best serve the community of McKenzie and realize significant cost savings to Menard Incorporated, therefore best serving orderly and economic development. Really, this came down to a very careful analysis of the 10 of the facts of this case and the 10 key issues. I had a little chart that I worked through outlining each of these issues. And going through one by one, 5 of them favored MDU, several strongly favored MDU, and the remaining were either neutral or not prevailing. To me, the key issue came down to orderly and economic development. The updates that MDU is going to be making will best serve the community of McKenzie, best prepare that community for growth that can be anticipated with a new job site with 240 new jobs and that level of growth in that area. And it results in $60,000 of annual savings to Menards, which also helps make that project more economically viable. So for me, it really came down to that one key factor supported by the customer's strong preference for service by MDU. And therefore, I'm moving forward with this motion today to approve this PCNN.
We have a motion and a second. Is there further discussion?
Do you want to go first?
I really have nothing to add to that. Okay. Pretty well characterized my sentiments.
All right, perfect. Well, it's interesting. I have a couple thoughts, I guess. There's three commissioners for a reason. We don't always agree. And this was one of those cases that I'm going to come down differently on that than perhaps my colleagues. And there was one thing that I have a dissent that I'll submit when this is all done, but there's one key date that was not that is not included in the order. And it is true we had May 2nd, we had a public hearing, and on June 13th, MDU filed a request for oral argument. But we had a work session in the middle of there. In that work session, I made it very clear that I thought that the one of the big points of MDU's argument was that the customer preferred them. Well, the customer admitted they didn't even know that there was two electric providers when they picked the spot. This spot was picked on because it was good location to rail service and a couple other reasons. So I made that very clear in the work session. And then the company, MDU, requested the oral arguments, which they made a lot of points in the oral arguments, but none that swayed me. And for me, it really comes down to just a couple things, is that first off, during testimony, the Menards witness the MDU witness from Menards made it very clear that they did not know there was two people that could provide services. So they made their decision completely on other factors. So the cost of electricity was never a factor in their decision. And so as this thing unfolded, of course they're going to go with the people that provide the lowest cost electricity. MDU is set up that way. Your investor owns provide lower cost electricity than your rural electrics. That's just the way it lays out because the rural electrics serve a lot larger area. That's where there's other things set into place. So I don't find it at all surprising that Menards would want to go with the lower cost once they picked it. But that's not the point. The point is that my last thing in my dissent, I'll read it. The commission has been guided for decades by a long history of cases from the Supreme Court. Customers in rural areas are best served by rural electric cooperatives, even when the customers prefer otherwise. So, you know, I think the customer preference and all the arguments that follow from that, I think are moot points because they didn't know who the customer was. And then the next two big things for me were basically that when we talk about the substation, Capital Electric can extend services to Menards for $82,000 less than MDU. So Capital can do this for $82,000 less than MDU. And so why would MDU want to do it? Well, they want the load, of course. But the point here is to say that MDU is going to make these upgrades to benefit the city of Minocan. Well, they didn't need to benefit the city of Minocan, otherwise they'd have already have done it. We don't know for sure the city of Minocan is going to grow. So to make that investment now just to serve this customer, that's duplication. And now wasteful, we'll wait and see, but it's clearly duplication. They don't, it's an unneeded investment right now. And so that was the second big issue for me. And then really, I think the MDU has to literally cross several Capital Electric lines to get to the facility. Yes, there are more MDU customers. We're talking 29 versus 11. So there was a lot of things that I would agree with my colleagues on. We're very close calls. But to me, it really just jumped out that, you know, Capital can extend the services for $82,000 less. Literally, MDU has to cross the area. Of course, they're going to pick the lowest cost, and that's the way. That's why investor owns are set up differently. I thought it was unique that the company's point, or the Menard said that they like being regulated by a commission. That implies that the co-ops don't do a good job of regulation. I think the co-ops do a very good job of regulation. So that one I just threw out there as a sidebar. And then I guess the last one, this would clearly provide for a checkerboarding in the area of McKenzie. We're now going to, if this goes through, which you're going to have a drop down in clearly a Capital area that is going to be served by MDU. So for me, when I heard the case, it was pretty clear to me that this was co-op territory. And then when I made that point clear in the work session,
MDU requested oral arguments, and they reinforced the same points they made before. And so I understand this is a very challenging case, but to me, I think you break it down to simplicity. Co-ops serve rural areas. Investor-owned serve cities. There's extra costs that MDU would have to incur, and this just doesn't make sense to go to the investor-owned.
Well, I'm going to reply a little bit to some of that because I saw it just in some ways the same, especially in your comments about co-ops regulating themselves and doing a good job. I entirely agree. They do a great job, and they would provide good service to this customer. There's no question about that. But to me, it came down to the orderly and economic development. MDU has been in this area since 1928. This is a natural extension of their service that has been in that area since for 86 years. And so I think that it came down to orderly and economic development. It's very likely that they would have had to, at some point in the near future, make these upgrades to that station because of the new Menards load and all the activity out there. And so if you're looking at the development of this area, this is the most economical and efficient way to do that, is providing the service through the MDU investments that are already there. And I would also disagree with my colleague, Commissioner Kalk, on his summary that investor-owned serve cities and co-ops serve rural areas, and that it's that simple. I think there's been a lot of Supreme Court cases on this very, very matter, and I was very intentional in including some language from Supreme Court decisions that the Territorial Integrity Act does not provide that rural electric cooperatives are the preferred supplier of electricity in all rural areas of the state, but it requires a public utility to obtain that PCNN before it extends its facilities. That's exactly what we're doing here. MDU came and said we want to extend our facilities a few thousand feet from where they exist right now to serve this customer. And so we go through the 10 criteria to decide, make the decision, and they five of the 10 fell strongly or clearly in the side of MDU, and so I think that the load goes to them in this case.
Is there any further discussion?
With this being a split situation, just for clarity of our record, you had mentioned Commissioner called the community of Minocan, and I think you probably meant McKenzie. Am
I
correct?
You're correct. Thank you. The birthplace of Tammy Aberle, just for the record.
Is there any further discussion? Sensing none, I'll proceed with a roll call vote. Commissioner Kalk.
Nay.
Commissioner Christman.
Aye.
Commissioner Fedorchak.
Aye.
The motion is approved.
Okay, moving on. I move the Commission adopt the order granting a Certificate of Public Convenience and Necessity in Bakken Link Pipeline, LLC, Crude Oil Pipeline, Williams to Billings County, Public Convenience and Necessity, Case Number PU-13-901.
Second.
On January 29th, on December 16th, Bakken Link Pipeline filed an application for a Certificate of Public Convenience and Necessity for a 132-mile bidirectional 12-inch and 8-inch crude oil pipeline and other facilities in Billings, Stark, McKenzie, and Williams counties, North Dakota. On January 29th, we issued a notice of opportunity for hearing identifying two issues to be considered in this matter. First, whether public convenience and necessity will be served by the construction and operation of the crude oil pipeline and other facilities. And two, whether the applicant is fit, willing, and able to provide service. We didn't receive any requests for hearings on March 12th. We held an informal hearing on this matter. The south 95 miles of the pipeline are currently in service, and the north 37 miles of this pipeline are located between Dry Creek Receipt Point and Beaver Lodge Receipt Point southwest of Tioga have not yet been constructed, and they're pending federal approval for the crossing of Lake Sakakawea. Bakken Link has been authorized to transact business in North Dakota since 2011. They indicate that the pipeline serves an area which is all land within approximately 10 miles on either side of the pipeline. They indicate there are no other pipelines that provide the service that is provided by this pipeline, and there's currently insufficient pipeline capacity to meet the current and anticipated future transportation needs producers in the Bakken and Three Forks development area. BakkenLink indicates that in comparison to transporting by truck, the pipeline provides a cost-effective means of transporting the crude oil and has the potential to reduce the environmental impacts of transportation by truck by reducing the number of truck miles by nearly 8.8 million truck miles per year. BakkenLink indicates that existing pipelines are at or near capacity. There are no public utilities providing a similar service in the area by the pipeline, and the pipeline will therefore not have an effect on other public utilities providing similar service. So working through all of the relevant issues, the commission finds that public convenience and necessity will be served by the construction and operation of the crude oil pipeline and other facilities because there's a need for the pipeline. The pipeline will not have an effect on other public utilities providing similar service. The proposed service will be adequate, and BakkenLink has a technical, financial, and managerial ability to provide the proposed service. The commission therefore orders that the application of BakkenLink for the CPNN is granted for the south segment. The CPNN number 5834 is issued to BakkenLink to construct and operate the south segment. The application for the PCNN is granted for the north segment, subject to the condition precedent that BakkenLink receive federal approval. BakkenLink shall notify the commission in writing of their receipt of federal approval for the north segment and shall notify the commission in writing of their intention to start construction on the north segment. This is the first PCNN for a pipeline that we've been through. I think it's a good process. I think it provides a mechanism to repeat duplication and help make sure that we're not overbuilding infrastructure or building repetitive infrastructure. So I applaud the company for seeking the PCNN, and I think it's something that we'll probably see more of in the future as our pipeline infrastructure is further developed.
We have a motion and a second. Is there further discussion?
I just had yesterday we had a work session with the three of us about some proposed bill drafts, and one of the things that came up was should we be asking the companies who asked for PCNNs for pipelines for a filing fee. And so we've just done that for electric. That's correct, isn't it, Patrick? I'm saying that correct. And so I think that's one thing you might see is in anticipation of more of these. And you know, this one I think was pretty cut and dried. It was the first time we'd seen it. We had an informal on it. It laid out very nicely. But one of the things I can see coming in the future is if another company wants to build a pipeline within that range, there may be a setup of a hearing coming. So we'll see how this plays out as well. But I do think one thing we will look forward is having PCNNs require a filing fee, just in case we have to do the full-blown hearings on these. I think that seems reasonable.
Is there further discussion?
Well, yeah, just almost in the form of a question to the portfolio holder, but really my understanding on this, the big thing that BakkenLink gets with this PCNN, it doesn't grant them any monopoly status or anything like that in the area. It just assures that they will have status in the case if someone else is going ahead and seeking to build something and also seeking PCNN. And they would also get notice in that case. And if someone is building and even doesn't request the PCNN, BakkenLink would also have status in those cases in the siting as well, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Hence the filing fee, because those will end up in hearings probably.
But I think it is important that we be clear that this does not prevent someone else necessarily from building in the area.
Yep. Is there further discussion? Since none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion is approved.
I move the commission deem complete the applications of Targa Badlands LLC for a waiver of procedures and time schedules, corridor certificate, and a route permit. I further move the commission issue a notice of filing and notice of hearing in Targa Badlands LLC 8-inch crude oil pipeline Montreal County siting application case number PU-14-625.
Second.
It's another pipeline application. On July 18th, Targa Badlands filed an application for a certificate of corridor compatibility and route permit inserting a 31.7-mile 8-inch crude oil pipeline and associated facilities in Montreal County. Also on July 18th, Targa filed an application for waivers of procedures and time schedules and waiver of the requirements for separate filings, separate notices, separate hearings on the applications. The commission now finds that these applications are complete. We'll set a date and time for the hearing, which will be in Newtown during our admin portion of the meeting. This pipeline basically runs from a little bit east of Newtown to just south of Stanley. Again, it's a 31.7 miles crude oil pipeline. And Julie, you'll have to remind me, what is the capacity of this pipeline? Do we have that in the filing?
Do some quick pipeline math, Julie. Well, 8-inch pipeline, 150,000 barrels a day. Depends on pressure.
It's all right.
And you're a Montana grad, correct, Julie? Grizzlies or Bobcats we play this weekend? Okay, that's good.
It's 48,960 barrels per day max.
Wow. Excellent. So we'll be setting the date for this hearing and holding a hearing out in Newtown on this matter in probably the next month or so.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion? Sensing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion is approved.
Just, before I conclude my portfolio, I do want to just back up and say thanks to all the parties involved in that Menard Inc. matter. It was a tough decisions, and they're heated discussions, and everybody conducted themselves very professionally and cordially, and it was a very positive process in the end. I think we were able to work through things in a very respectable manner, and I appreciate that.
I would just add to my opening comments about how this commission made decisions on that ABS transmission line. The same thing with this Menard case. We worked through it. We made decisions. We don't hang things up. We get to the point, talk it through, and make decisions. So, and I appreciate Commissioner Crispin pointing out my tongue tying between Minocan and McKenzie. It's Capital Electric's Minocan substation to serve the town area. So thank you. All right, anything else, Commissioner Fedorchak?
That's it.
Commissioner Crispin?
Just to point out on those awards that I mentioned, the award ceremony at the Lignite Energy Council will be October 1st at the noon award luncheon.
And will you be presenting those certificates as the portfolio holder?
I have it marked on my calendar. I couldn't be more proud to do so.
All right, perfect. All right, are there any questions, comments from the crowd?
Just a clarification on this Menard facility. Is that the trust plant we're talking about, or is it something else?
That's part of it, yeah. They have seven different lines that they'll be incorporating into that distribution center, and I believe trusses was one of the items that they're going to be working on there. But there's a small, like, concrete mix plant, and there's a number of different lines that they're going to be developing in that facility.
So it'd be fair to call it a distribution center.
Distribution center is the correct term, and it's the first distribution center in North Dakota. I think it's the first distribution center west of Minneapolis, and I don't know from how far west, but it's a significant new investment by Menards. It really speaks to their view of the ongoing growth in North Dakota and the housing growth long term in this region.
Do you remember what figure they're going to invest? What their investment figure is? I probably can look that up.
Let me see. Jerry, does that figure come to mind? How much was it costing?
I don't know if we had it.
Did they? I know they talked about the number of jobs. Dave, I'll dig around here for a second. I might have that.
What will be interesting on this one, Dave, is to see how this all plays out once again, because this is not the end of this discussion around the city. Because hopefully Capital Electric and MDU can sit down and figure something out now, because otherwise what will happen, you can see that the co-op growth will continue in the co-op area that's already being served by the single phase. And so you'll have a drop down where Monocan, or once the MDU plant being served by MDU, will be literally right in the middle. So as the town grows, as the rural grows, there's still a lot of undefined area in those seams.
Well, given the fact that it was a 2-to-1 vote, do you anticipate legal action?
You know, I don't know. I'm putting a dissent order together with more clarity so it can be it will be filed, and that'll be up to the companies. I guess my preference would be like it was in the very beginning, that you've got two very good companies that sit down in a room and they figure out, just like they do in the rest of the state. I mean, we have now up to almost 30 agreements between investor owns and co-ops, where they set up their who's going to serve what area. I would encourage both these companies to do that, because it's better to define it now than to have us go through this every time, and which we're happy to do that. It would just seem to make more sense for orderly development that these two companies sit down and work out that.
I don't have the figure.
Okay, not a problem. I want one quick clarification on RC4 about Dakota Spirit Ag Energy. Are they going to keep the Wimbledon facility and open another one at Spiritwood?
I don't know how long-term the Wimbledon facility will be. We'll see next year again, I guess, whether they want to renew. But, yes, there will be a storage facility up at the ethanol plant that will they'll seek license for when that's done.
Well, I might as well ask about the STB, because I was curious about now what. Because I'm sure everybody's thinking, now what? Because the reports still keep coming that BNSF may be making some progress. CP is in some kind of denial mode, what has been characterized in some of the reports. And this morning there was a report from our Inside Energy folks that even it's affecting coal shipments.
Absolutely.
Along BN southern routes. So, you know, now the STB has held this hearing, what now?
Well, in that hearing, and Randy and I both testified at that hearing, we requested a number of things. We requested them to basically seek the information that we asked the railroads to provide us, which was a lot of information in terms of the time difference between cars being received and loaded and taken to their final destination, the differences between various sectors, say ag and energy and coal, et cetera. And we asked for a number of different reports, all of which the railroads firmly denied having to provide us and said, you can get that from STB. So now we're saying, STB, we want you to get that. Please do that. And so that was one thing. I asked for them to file more detailed plans for their operations this fall. They do file a peak demand plan for how they're going to deal with the service, but they're pretty short, not very in-depth plans, and so I think the STB needs to demand more of them on a year like this to make sure that they are we're all understanding how they're going to meet this demand, and not just now, but through October, November. I mean, we haven't really even seen the peak demand yet, and so I think there's a lot of folks that are concerned about how this is going to work come October and November. So I think that would be helpful for them to know that they have to be transparent what their plans are, and people can make their plans accordingly, and that the STB is watching carefully. And then we asked for them to set up a temporary field office in North Dakota to help, again, monitor and provide more oversight and more involvement between the STB and the shippers and producers and the railroads. I think that would be a really positive step, just to provide more presence in the state for the STB, the primary regulator of this industry, and have so they can see firsthand what's going on, and also provide more accountability with the railroads and a voice that can actually have some results with the railroads right here in the state, so for the shippers and producers. So I think that would be a real positive step for them to take. I'm going to just call the STB and find out what their plans are moving forward, and if what they plan to do with any of those requests, and hear from them on what they what their timeline is. I did find it interesting in talking to some other folks who have been involved in this industry for decades, for their whole careers during the STB meeting. They indicated that typically the STB has a field hearing or has meetings such as this when they are prepared to do something, take some course of action. So I have some comfort that they don't plan on just listening and doing nothing. I do feel that they are preparing to take some action, and I hope that it's real positive, constructive action that's going to help the industry meet this fall peak, demand in a smooth way that doesn't jeopardize our producers or the energy side, or just helps really meet the needs of everybody who's relying on the rail system.
I would add to that that, you know, after that hearing, they kept the period open for comments. I think the comment period closed maybe last Thursday or something like that. So it really hasn't been very long since that ended. In our dialogue, Commissioner Miller, you know, asked for more specifics on just what information we might want, and I did send in a letter requesting some more specifics that I could get you a copy of. But since then, I do know, I'm aware that the chairman of the STB sent a letter to, I don't know, one or more senators on whatever the appropriate committee that has oversight in that area in Washington. And it was pretty strongly worded, kind of reiterating a lot of the problems and making clear that he certainly intended to take strong action, but didn't really tip his hand a lot of exactly what that will be.
Dave, I could just throw my two cents worth too on this. We have the challenges in the fall we have to get through, but long term, and the solution is pretty simple. They need more track, they need more crews, they need more engines. And so the BN and the CP have to make those investments because that's what needs to happen. And then from, I guess, my viewpoint in the commission, our role of pipeline siting even becomes more important. You get the stress off the rails, you get more crews, that's the solution. So we've heard of the Dakota Access Pipeline moving all kinds of oil. We've heard of the Enterprise Pipeline. We've done our job on the Enbridge Pipeline. And so you think about those pipelines, if you total those up, it's almost, well, it's 1.3 million barrels a day of what those pipelines can move. And so if those pipelines get properly constructed and built, think of how much capacity you're going to free up in the railroads. And so it's really good to see the pipeline solution in the queue, if you will. We've not seen those filings yet. Well, the Enbridge one we've acted on, but the other two, we know they're coming. And so I think that's what we can do in the Public Service Commission here is make sure we do our good, thorough review. But that's going to be the long-term solution is build the pipelines, get the crews, and then the problem worked itself out. Because Randy talked about in Mayville, it's not just the oil. The farm movement of commodities has changed so much. You're not moving barley and wheat anymore. You're moving all kinds of different crop with all different volumes, different size. I mean, so there's a lot of different stresses out there. And you asked about the coal. We've heard from both Xcel and Otter Tail of their concerns about some of their coal generation plants that they don't have the stockpiles they need. And so we're looking at this a lot of different ways. And then jumping back to North Dakota, it makes it even more beneficial to keep our coal plants alive and well because we don't have to worry about shipping coal to the generation. We've got the coal right there in mine mouth that goes right to the plant that there's no transportation issues with. So it just makes it to keep our plants alive and well even more important as we go into these CO2 rules.
So just clarify, Xcel and Otter Tail are both saying they're concerned because the stockpiles are not where they should be?
Yes, I've got letters or emails from both of their people saying you should be aware of this. And I'm sure if that's Otter Tail MDU, I'll look at Tammy over there. MDU has a lot of the shared stuff, so they would have that concern as well.
MDU filed comments to the STB hearing as well.
And our neighbors at Minnesota Power actually have some coal facilities that are shut down. They're just doing maintenance and such on them. The maintenance that I believe was not in the normal plan, but just in order to save their coal for this winter when it's colder. And that's a shame for their customers. They're not North Dakota customers, but for anybody to be having to pay more for power now because the plant can't get coal and they have to go to other sources.
One more quick question on pipelines. Sandpiper.
Yes.
That's approved. Apparently ground is being broken in North Dakota to build it. Minnesota, I think they had a hearing last week.
They've had discussion. The way I understand it, the Minnesota Commission has asked for six different routes to be studied. And not all the routes even go to where the pipeline's supposed to start and stop at. So I find those bizarre, what's going on over there. But that's a different jurisdiction, I guess.
Yeah. You never have any conversations with them, do you?
We know all the commissioners over there, and we just reinforce to them in North Dakota we make decisions based on information and we don't study things to death. But yeah, it's not appropriate, I guess, for me to talk to the commissioners about projects.
Sure.
We certainly have general conversations. But I think theirs was a 3-2 vote. And so to go down that road a little farther, we've had a lot of the labor unions come to support the pipeline projects in North Dakota. I know that the same labor unions that came to our Enbridge hearings are now heavily engaged in Minnesota to lobby Governor Dayton and his appointed majority of their Public Utilities Commission to make decisions over there.
That pipeline project creates 10,000 jobs in North Dakota. So I'm sure it's similar in Minnesota as well.
It'll be interesting if that plays out, Dave.
Yeah.
But it could. The ramifications to us, though, are just like that CapEx transmission line. If Minnesota approves a route that is different than a North Dakota point, they do have to meet somewhere. So what they do over there can certainly affect our hearings here in North Dakota. So we're watching those very closely.
Well, it really underscores, too, that there's folks out there who, in my view, aren't very realistic about energy and what we use, how much we need, and how it's transported. So they're fighting pipeline development. They're fighting rail use. Nobody likes trucks on the road driving this stuff. But the reality is we need this energy. We need these fuels. You know, you can't take a hot shower without gas to heat your water. You can't, you know, have refrigeration without electricity to plug your fridge into. You can't drive your car. You can't fill it with gas. You can't charge your phone. You can't do anything without energy. So how are we going to get it? And what's the safest method? We know pipelines are by far the safest, most efficient way to transport crude oil and gas. So this is a very sensible project. They do have to do it right. There's a lot of water in Minnesota, and I think that's been some of the concerns is the routing. But I don't know how you get around the water in Minnesota. It's the land of 10,000 lakes, so I guess I don't know the route through Minnesota that doesn't impact water. And there's a lot of existing pipeline infrastructure that I think people maybe aren't aware of that already is functioning very safely through that state. So I hope that they don't drag this out. It's 250,000 barrels per day of our crude oil that can be moving through safely operated, well-managed, and a good oversight pipeline. And I would hope that we could bring that online as soon as possible.
I think it shows, Dave, really a key distinction and difference between both the regulatory and the policymaking mentality of North Dakota and Minnesota, and why North Dakota is working and Minnesota is really not.
And there you have it. Anything else, Dave? Okay, Julie, anything else?
Nope.
Anything else? All right, we'll close the official portion of our meeting and let's reconvene in 10 minutes. Is that enough time?
Sure.
All right.